knee-high blueberry bushes. Occasionally, tufts of grass were surrounded by piles of moss and pillows of spindly lichen. The sky was gray, and it was beginning to rain, but Ninja Mike and I dropped our packs. "What are you doing?" Tupac asked. I knelt and examined the lichen, which looked like shrunken coral up close. "Are you kidding? This place is amazing. Look at it." Ninja Mike was already standing on a rock pile with his arms outstretched. "See? He gets it." Breakfast Club was on Tupac's side. "My guess is that this rain picks up and you guys have a miserable time." Ninja Mike opened one eye and looked over his shoulder. "The rain is part of what makes this place so beautiful." Tupac laughed. "When you two hippies are done picking a name for your cult, Breakfast Club and I will be somewhere down that way. We'll be the two dry guys eating warm rice." Ninja Mike and I stayed at the top for another hour, munching on blueberries and examining the various mosses and fungi. Neither of us knew what we were looking at, but their diversity and assortment of colors were mesmerizing. While we were distracted by the little things, the rain stopped and we failed to notice. I stood up. Through a break in the pines, I could see a dark gray pyramid, substantially taller than the one we were on. "Hey, look, is that Mount Success?" "I think so. You know what's on the other side of that, right?" Ninja Mike asked. "Success?" He smirked. "Maybe. Hopefully." The real answer was Maine. The state line was on the far side of Mount Success, a mere 2 miles beyond the summit. We could almost see it from here. I sat back down, and we watched black and gray clouds swirl slowly over the top of the mountain. Ninja Mike asked me if I had ever heard of Pamola. "Is that what we're going to name our cult?" "We could. Pamola was the name of the god of thunder for the people who were here before us. The dude had wings of an eagle and the head of a moose. Guess where he lived?"
"Katahdin?"
He nodded. "Katahdin, home of the storm god. That's why they said it always has a dark cloud over it." He touched a pile of moss to check if it was dry and then used it as a pillow. It was dusk and bright stars were appearing between the clouds. "I like to think of Katahdin as the final boss fight in a video game. The difficulty just keeps ramping up and up until there's this giant epic bastard at the end, you know?" "I like your analogy, Ninja Mike. But for me, I like to think of all this as something I've already done."
"What do you mean?" he said, propping up on his elbows.
"It's a trick I did in boot camp to pass the time. That place was constantly miserable, so I pretended it was already over, and that everything happening around me in the present was actually just me remembering it. I'm not miserable here, at least not too often, but I do the same thing when I zone out on the trail sometimes. On those days when it feels like Katahdin is a million miles away, I time travel into a future where the goal is already complete, and I pretend that all this is me simply looking back on how I got there."
"That almost makes sense, brother." He sank back into the moss.
As the air cooled, the clouds thinned and eventually vanished, revealing a multitude of stars. We marveled at the view and muddled over the idea of our universe being a single electron in some massive atom. Staring at the Milky Way from the top of a mountain will do that to you. As the temperature dropped and dew began to collect on the moss, we gathered our packs by starlight and slowly climbed down into the dark, carefully placing our feet and poles on the slanted rocks. After about a mile, Ninja Mike pointed to a shimmering red glow at the top of a distant ridge.
"That has to be them. Holy shit, did they make a bonfire?"
I put my head next to his and squinted.
"I don't know. That's a lot of light."
We continued walking, and the light continued to grow. Sometimes it was difficult to see directly because of the thick trees, but after a few minutes there was no mistaking it. The glow was getting redder and bigger.
"It looks like they're trying to signal the aliens," Ninja Mike said.
My heart raced. I took a breath.
"What if that's not them?
What if that's a wildfire?" The far-off light flickered through the thick branches, now orange and much larger. Almost half the sky was glowing from that direction. He took a step back.
"Oh, fuck, dude. That's a fucking fire. Run!"
We turned and sprinted back the way we had come. It didn't look like the blaze was directly on the trail, so I hoped Tupac and Breakfast Club were okay. They were probably already fleeing north. When I made it back to the top under the stars again, I fell wheezing into the moss. Ninja Mike had beaten me there, and he was doubled over, laughing. I caught my breath.
"What?"
I pushed up to my knees and repeated myself.
"What?"
He pointed. I felt like an idiot. The top half of the rising full moon had crested the horizon behind us,
blood red and casting long crimson streaks among the shadows of the thick black pines. When the boughs waved in the breeze, pumpkin-colored moonlight and triangular black shadows flickered like flames while bright orange flashes danced across the surface of a pond in the valley below. Oh my God, Ninja Mike, were we just afraid of the moon? He wiped his eyes. Oh dude, we just went full fucking Neanderthal. He pointed at the moon and grunted. Skyfire! Scary!
Ah!
He fell back into the moss and howled. Now that our flight had put us back in prime stargazing territory, we stayed up on Mount Hayes, past hiker midnight, and even actual midnight, until the moonlight defeated all but the brightest stars. When we eventually found Tupac and Breakfast Club sleeping beside the trail, we woke them up as we guffawed and grunted like cavemen at the glowing remains of their puny fire. The next morning, Tupac and Breakfast Club were the ones laughing as Ninja Mike and I grumbled beside our own puny fire. I think that 6 more hours of sleep would be perfect, I groaned. I'm exhausted. Tupac was already tying his shoes. Sounds like you forgot to take your Triactin. What's Triactin? Triactin like a man. Breakfast Club spat coffee and Ninja Mike snorted. We gathered around Tupac's map to see what lay ahead. All we had to do was get up and over Mount Success. Since we were likely to split up along the way, we agreed to wait at the sign for Maine and all step over the line together. The whites were behind us now, which meant that we should be able to get back to our big mileage. It was 8 miles to the summit and 2 more to Maine. Hell, we could probably be there by lunchtime, said Tupac. Breakfast Club pushed his finger east of the state line. These climbs are steep, but look how small they are. We could even be at the start of Mahoosic Notch by the end of the day. The start of? Ninja Mike scoffed. Let's get through that fucker. Mahoosic Notch is notoriously the most difficult mile of the entire Appalachian Trail, although that same mile is frequently described as the most fun. The Notch is a mile-long jumbled boulder pit with rocks as big as cars and houses, and the only way through is to scale them or squirm under them. A few years before, a moose had wandered in and fallen into one of the many deep crevasses. It broke a leg and lay there bellowing for days, until some kind soul with a hunting knife finally showed the only mercy possible by climbing down and slitting the poor thing's jugular. Let's get to Maine first, guys. Then we'll see how it goes. I don't want to find my way through the Notch by headlamp. Even I had been too optimistic, surprised, to end the day still in New Hampshire. When I finally reached the top of Mount Success, Ninja Mike was on his back in the moss, wearily twirling a trekking pole. Tupac was trying and failing to find firewood, and Breakfast Club was filtering rainwater collected from a dip in the exposed rock. I dropped my pack and squatted. How many times, guys? How many times what? Asked Ninja Mike from his bed of moss. How many times did you think you were at the top of this thing before you finally got here? I stopped counting at 12, yelled Breakfast Club from our puddle. I guess if we're going to fail, said Tupac from over by the empty fire ring, here would be the best place to do it. The sky was mostly clear, and they had already rolled out their bags on the rocks. They invited me to stay, but with my light summer sleeping bag, I relied on my thin tent to retain at least some heat while I slept. Instead, I raced down the backside of Mount Success, desperately seeking for any flat spot big enough to make camp. For at least a mile past the summit, the greatest distance between two pines could be measured in inches. Even if I wanted to collapse on the ground, I couldn't. There never was any ground. It was almost dark when I finally found my home for the night. Someone in a similar predicament must have become frustrated and chopped down just enough trees to clear just enough room for a single small tent. This was not some cute little campsite with a tiny fire ring and rock chairs. It was a flat patch of dirt, so minuscule that I was genuinely concerned about someone tripping over me in the night. After I pitched my tent and wriggled in, I could easily reach out and touch the trail. I awoke to the sound of gentle rain. The trees were collecting mist from the clouds and dripping onto my tent. The wind far above howled, and I wondered how Ninja Mike and the gang were doing. I was about to take my first sip of hot coffee when I heard them coming. Ninja Mike was at the front of their soggy parade, testily repeating his mantra. I am grateful for today. I am grateful for today. I am... There he is. Fuck you, Green Giant. My tent was already packed up, so we crowded into the flat spot like 4 men in an elevator. I raised my cup and took another sip. How was your night?
Night was fine, but I didn't get to do any yoga before hauling ass down here. I was just snoring, then dreaming, then bam, eyes open, fuck, run.
We beat the worst of it, though.
Notch today?
Notch today, we high-fived.
Of course we didn't make the notch that day.
Full Goose Shelter, 5 miles into Maine, was as far as our excitement from crossing the state line could carry us. There was still plenty of time and sunlight left to get through Mahoosic Notch if we really wanted to. There was even a campsite with water at the other side. But no one said a word. We all started unpacking as soon as we arrived. Ninja Mike gathered wood and started a fire, even though it was only 3 in the afternoon. We sat around it and watched the coals. We had crossed into Maine almost first thing after coffee. There was a simple white sign with simple black letters and a whole lot of trees. We tried to celebrate as best we could, but energy was scarce. The trail rambled through piles of moss-coated dead trees that leaned in every direction. Much of the moss was thick enough that ferns and other large plants grew among it. In many places, new trees sprouted right atop the dead logs and boulders. Everything was wet and smelled ancient. The vertical rock walls started almost immediately upon entering Maine. Rebar ladders and boulder scrambles took us up the sides of unnamed mountains taller than skyscrapers, where we could see for miles, while in the valleys between we could barely find each other. Maine was a beautiful obstacle course, and we were bruised and bleeding after only 5 miles. Tupac made each of us some of his famous bandana coffee, and my cup was cool before I had even drunk half. We huddled and shivered at the shelter while more hikers filed in. By dark, the place was packed, and rumor had it that still more were coming. The box was full, and almost every tent site was taken. I pitched my tent behind the shelter and rejoined the growing crowd by the fire. There must have been 30 people shoulder to shoulder around the flames, and only one person was speaking. Someone I didn't recognize said nervously, "I told everyone back home that I was hiking from Georgia to Maine. If I go home tomorrow, I guess technically that means I met my goal, right?" No one answered, but a few nodded. We were all bushed, and that was just as contagious as the misguided enthusiasm we had shared at the start of the day. I quarantined myself in my tent and shivered all night, despite wearing every article of clothing I had. It was good that we stopped early, because Mahoosic Notch was every bit as demanding as we feared. 2 nearly vertical rock walls have been crumbling into the vast pit between for millennia. For 2 hours, I balanced, climbed, leapt, and pulled my way across, around, and under mammoth rocks of every shape. In many places, I hung by my fingers, unsure where to go. Once I spied a white arrow pointing the way into an impossibly small gap. I trusted the paint, took off my pack, and dropped it, then lowered myself into the blackness. I could see light at the other end, but had to feel my way to it, alternately pushing or dragging my pack through several tight squeezes. Unseen water gurgled somewhere in the cold below, and I couldn't help imagining my fate should I slip and fall into it. The notch was intense, but brief, and soon I was back on normal trail, or at least what passes for normal in Maine. Somewhere along the boulders, I lost track of everyone, so I climbed up and over the next mountain solo. Old Speck is a 3,000-foot monster that drops into Grafton Notch on the other side, where there is a small parking lot and a 2-lane blacktop road. A few cars were there, and one hiker, Lemmy. I jogged toward him, calling from across the lot, "Hey, buddy, I thought you were behind me. Maine is a strange place, huh?" He nodded. "Tupac and Breakfast Club just left. They are hitching to Andover for supplies." "What about Ninja Mike? Did he go with them, or is he up ahead?" I indicated the next big climb just across the road.
"No," Lemmy said, "he is gone."
"What do you mean, gone? I didn't pass him. Where is he?"
"I mean he is done. Ninja Mike said goodbye."
Ninja Mike hadn't been injured, at least not as far as Lemmy could tell. He had last seen Ninja Mike smiling and waving from the back of a truck mysteriously headed away from the nearest town. Maybe Tupac or Breakfast Club could fill in the blanks, assuming I ever saw them again. The next day was warmer but still gray. Lemmy and I climbed over the Bald Pates, a close pair of high, exposed, rocky balds with a grassy saddle between them. High winds forced us to cut short our stay at the top. On the way down, I found an overlook with cell phone coverage and used the opportunity to arrange a shuttle to a hostel called The Cabin in Andover. The Cabin is run by a charming retired couple known as Honey and Bear. I talked to Honey on the phone, and she told me where we'd meet, so I was surprised when a younger man greeted us at the road crossing. He was closer to my age than retirement, so I assumed he wasn't Bear. He wore an old, beat-up cowboy hat and a vest with many pockets, and he looked familiar. I waved. "Hi, I'm Green Giant. This is Lemmy." He returned my wave and opened the trunk. "Hi, guys. Honey usually drives, but the bubble is here, so I'm helping out. I'm Squatch." "Squatch? I saw one of your movies not too long ago, back at Hudson's place." He removed his hat and bowed deeply. "Guilty as charged, and at your service. How did you like it? Careful how you answer, I have all of your belongings." He shut the trunk and smiled. I tried to count the people at The Cabin, but every time I got to 30, I started double counting as they moved from room to room. Tupac and Breakfast Club were nowhere to be seen, and the logbook showed that they had departed that morning, probably trying to get ahead of the bubble. There were so many hikers in town that Honey and Bear had to augment their generous bunkhouse with a squadron of trailers a la Load, and even those needed to be double and triple booked. Somehow, I scored a bottom bunk inside the main house. The bunk's top occupant was about to leave for the day when Lemmy threw his own gear among the neat stacks of food bags and clean laundry. "I will sleep here tonight. This is the best spot." Miss Janet was in town, and so was her friend and ally, Baltimore Jack. He knows the trail like the tops of his boots, having walked the whole thing 9 times, and authored the very spreadsheet Katie and I found online during our preliminary research. Baltimore Jack is also the culinary counterpart to Miss Janet's shuttle, and being an excellent cook has made Baltimore Jack huge, both in reputation and in girth. When I met him, he was mostly yellow blazing from town to town, leveraging his kitchen skills for bunk time whenever possible. Baltimore Jack and Miss Janet helped our hosts drive everyone into town that night for resupply and an all-you-can-eat pizza buffet. We filled the restaurant to capacity, yet there was little conversation. Everyone was tired of repeating themselves. We were all nervous about Katahdin and the 100-mile wilderness. Our guidebooks were down to the last few pages, and we each had them memorized. Every campsite, shelter, water source, and bunkhouse between here and Katahdin had been evaluated, analyzed, and appraised ad nauseam. At breakfast, I ate pancakes at the table with Miss Janet, while Baltimore Jack fried bacon and talked at length about music and the weather. I tried not to look starstruck when Squatch asked me for the syrup. When it was time to go, we loaded up every vehicle possible, and I corralled hikers into the van and tried to keep count while Miss Janet strapped packs to the roof. "Okay, Miss Janet, we're almost ready. As soon as Lemmy gets in..." "Has anyone seen Lemmy?" Of course no one had. I ran back into the house, and Lemmy's pack was still open and on his bunk. The shower was running, and I could hear him singing. "I'm not even going to try," I thought, and jogged back to the van. If I had been so naive as to continue trusting the elevation profile, I would have expected an easy day leaving Andover. A bird's-eye view reveals the truth. In southern Maine, the trail twists like a snake. In order to travel 5 miles north, you must first walk a quarter mile west. You might have to go up and over 2 500-foot mountains along the way, but don't worry, for some reason you'll go around the third one. At the bog, you'll make a sharp right and then walk 2 miles northeast through chest-deep brackish water populated by swarms of weird bugs and the weird plants that eat them. Moss-covered, partially rotted balance beams will help you get across most of the mess. Then you'll make another hard right and ascend a rocky bald, turn left, climb down the ladder, wade through more bogs, turn left at the moose, and keep going until you're on the other side of West of Nothing Pond. If the trail in southern Maine were a piece of string and you could pick up a mile of it, pulled tight, it would be at least 3 times as long. And every bit of it is almost too lovely to believe. The mud is coal black and smells like a freshly opened bag of potting soil. Twisted pines are coated with green, velvety lichen, and motes of dust hover in shafts of sun. I was beginning to understand what that southbounder meant about his heart hurting because he missed this place so much. Which reminded me, the water purification drops his friend had given me were almost used up. With only 2 or 3 more towns left, I'd have to remember to add this to my list. At the end of the day, I found myself camped at the base of Sawyer Notch, a deep V, running parallel to the sun's path, keeping the deepest part in shadow all day. From the small brook at the bottom, I could see long icicles hanging along the rock walls that were next morning's climb. Silver mist rolled over the mountains. Amid the yellowing trees I'd grown used to were now occasional streaks of rust, and the trail became surprisingly gentle, at least compared to the prior section. Over the next few days, I walked mostly under the cover of trees or beside large ponds. I saw my first moose track near a place called Unnamed Gap, but no moose. When I reached the road crossing nearest Rangeley, the rust-colored leaves had bloomed into bold red. The oaks were as bright as fresh oranges, and some of the maples were purple. With the blue sky and espresso-colored mud, every primary color was represented. I stuck out my thumb and waited. I didn't have to wait long. The first driver to stop was Stacy from the Farmhouse Inn. They had just opened down the road in Rangeley and weren't listed in the guidebook yet. She was dropping off and picking up, so I climbed in back and thanked her for the lift. The Farmhouse Inn is a beautiful old hotel and restaurant that sits atop rolling green acres overlooking Rangeley Lake. The bunk rooms were all renovated, and it also had plenty of bathrooms, hidden staircases, twisting hallways, and private rooms with wood-burning stoves. The small store had been cleaned out by the bubble, but a young man with a neat beard and a small pig under one arm had the solution to my problem. "Hi, I'm Nuke," he said, offering me his non-hog hand to shake. "This little guy doesn't have a name yet." He put the pig on the floor, and it ran up the nearest flight of stairs.
"Is his room up there?"
"It is. He's almost housebroken. Follow me." Nuke turned a corner, opened a screen door onto the back deck, and stepped down into the yard. "Down there? I'm already housebroken." We walked to the garage, where Nuke proudly showed me a row of bicycles in various states of repair before choosing one that seemed my size. "Go empty your pack and bring it back while I give this thing a little air." When I came back, the bike was dusted off and ready, with three working gears and the seat raised to maximum height for me. Nuke gave me directions to the best pizza in town, then explained his strongly recommended game plan. Though there were two more towns between here and Baxter State Park, the home of Mount Katahdin, neither were useful for resupply, he said. I was advised to fill my pack today at the local grocery store with everything I would need between here and the end. I should keep enough food to get me from here to Monson, at the start of the 100-mile wilderness, Nuke instructed. The rest I should mail to myself at the post office in Monson. I leaned on the handlebars and adjusted my pack. Why am I doing all this? Surely there's some kind of general store or gas station or something in Monson. It's the town immediately before a place called the 100-mile wilderness. He laughed. That's exactly why there isn't anything there. But with all that foot traffic, why haven't these places grown and turned into trail towns like Hot Springs or Damascus? Nuke shook his head. We don't even have billboards in Maine. Well, what about my water drops? Is there a place that sells filters? It's wilderness, Green Giant. After the grocery store here, the only thing you'll find for sale is fish hooks and hand warmers. Welcome to Maine. He looked at the sun. Better hurry. Post office closes soon. Before I pedaled off, he leaned close and whispered, Also, this might be a little embarrassing, but you need to hear it. You kind of smell like cat pee. Do you know what that means? Yeah, unfortunately I do. I sat in front of the grocery store and tried to calculate the number of days I'd need, but there were too many unknowns. There were still a handful of medium-sized climbs yet, and though the majority of the wilderness looked flat, I'd learned that looks were deceiving. I did my best with the math and bought more just in case. When I hauled my booty out to the bike, I was faced with yet another puzzle. Even unpackaged, my haul amounted to more than my pack could hold. I tied bags to the outside straps, gripped a bag at each handlebar, and wobbled to the post office. A half dozen other hikers were double-checking each other's math as they packed food into boxes. After a hot shower back at the inn, I called Katie but couldn't get a signal. There was Wi-Fi, though, so I emailed her an update. In the morning, I had a reply. She had reserved a lean-to shelter for the two of us at Katahdin Stream Campground, along the AT just before Mount Katahdin. She'd get there a few days early and take a mini-vacation in the mountains. And she would be bringing food. I lumbered out of Rangeley with an overloaded pack, but I was ultimately glad that I listened to Nuke. the first climb out is a legend among vortexes. The shelter at the base of Saddleback Mountain has a two-seater privy with a cribbage board between the thrones. Welcome to Maine, indeed. The 3 miles which follow twist and turn and rise and fall so drastically that I only realized I was going backwards when I saw the two-seater privy a second time. For nearly 2 hours I had passed streams and big obvious rocks that seemed familiar, figuring I had become delirious from hunger. I even had to step aside for Mecca, a hiker I had just seen in Rangeley coming the opposite way. He gave me a confused look. Apparently, a lack of protein doesn't merely make you smell like pee, it also makes you stupid, too. I chewed a melted protein bar while I tried to put myself back on course. As I realized the magnitude of my error, I ate a second one, and then a third. They didn't make me smarter, but it made me feel better about my mistake. My blunder cost me time and supplies. The shameful fists of chocolate that followed the protein bars meant that I had to eat less over the next few days. That was unfortunate, because the medium-sized climbs weren't so medium-sized after all. I had to scale back on my dwindling water drops, too. The recommended dose was probably set by the government, I rationalized, and was no doubt twice the amount truly required. Erring on the safe side, I settled somewhere in the middle. There was little choice. A day and a half later, I was on my way down the north side of Avery Peak, the last high point before 100 miles of lowland. From the summit, the smaller hills below looked like endless mounds of gold and copper coins shining in the sun. Clusters of plum-colored maples formed chunks of garnet tossed among the treasure. Nightwalker crashed through the bush and into the clearing so noisily that I genuinely thought a bear was charging. The last time I had seen him was in the Smokies, in the cage. Nightwalker! Holy shit! Is that... Now wait. Jolly Green Giant? Close enough. We shook hands. I guess you're flip-flopping after all. You know it, man. And I need to hustle, too. It's getting cold up there. Hey, whatever happened to that crazy girl you were hiking with? Good question. She's somewhere back there. I pointed behind me, the way he was headed. When you see her, tell her I said hi. We both hiked on. At the bottom of the mountain, the trail flattened out and followed the shoreline of East Flagstaff Lake. At the far end of the lake, I found a large campsite along a flat pebble beach. Long hunks of driftwood had been arranged into a comfortable seating area surrounding a large stone fire pit, already stacked full with dry branches. The fire lit easily, and I had no need for my tent. As the sun set, I stripped to my shorts and waded into the lake to feel the cool water splash on my shins. The rocks were all perfectly smooth discs, and walking on them barefoot in the gentle waves was like getting a foot massage. The sky darkened, and I stayed in the water, watching the red mountains slowly dim to dark shadows, massive black humps backlit by a tapestry of stars. The Milky Way blazed overhead, a golden streak against the perfect charcoal sky. Yellow light bounced off the water, and I had to squint against it while I rechecked my math. If I eat the last tortilla tonight and put the mayonnaise packet on it, that leaves me one Cliff Bar for tomorrow. And the day after that, a raisin. I had eaten my last pinch of homemade granola for second breakfast earlier that morning, and when I reached the bottom of the bag, I spared the last raisin just in case. This was that case. I closed my eyes, took a breath, and fell back into the water. When I came up, I opened my eyes and floated on my back under the galaxy, smiling. I had the stars and a raisin. What more did I need? I took another breath and said it aloud. I am grateful for today. Chapter 25. Landing. Way back at the start, I made an assumption about hunger. That assumption was that I knew what the word meant. I thought I knew what hunger was the time I sprinted to the bottom of a hill for a slice of pizza offered by a stranger. I thought it was getting to the top of a mountain and needing to save part of the beef jerky for later. I've never been out of food in my life. Even as a bachelor, when the fridge was empty, it still had eggs or old mustard packets to suck on for calories if it came down to it. Or I could just walk to the store, like a person. Even during the hardest parts of my childhood, we could run across the street and share a plate of watery spaghetti with Grandma. Real hunger makes you hallucinate. It interrupts every thought, every action. If necessity is the mother of invention, Hunger is its weird uncle who sleeps in the woods, dreaming up ways to trap and eat squirrels. It was a long way from my magnificent pebble beach to Monson, but at least the terrain and the weather were on my side. First, I was finished climbing mountains, until at least Katahdin, the god of thunder. A few tall spots and rocky balds, but no more knee breakers. It would mostly be rivers and ponds, with warm days and cool, clear nights. I split the last cliff bar in two, and the evening that I feasted on the second half, my stomach grumbled all night at Pleasant Pond Shelter. I dreamed that I had discovered a previously forgotten protein bar in the depths of my pack. I awoke and drank a full bottle of water to trick myself into thinking my belly was full, but the plan backfired when I had to pee it all out an hour later. I remembered that I still had my raisin. I dug it out of my pack and looked at it. If I eat this raisin, I have nothing, I thought. Reluctantly, I closed the bag and put it away. The loons and I watched the sun rise, and then I hiked on toward Monson and the post office with my food. That afternoon, I was the grateful recipient of real trail magic. There were no angels or magicians involved. This magic came directly from the trail itself in the form of blueberries. At the top of Moxie Bald, just a few feet from the trail, there they were. It was a small bush, and they were impossibly late in the season, but I wasn't hallucinating. I took off my pack and crawled into the bushes, picking blueberries and eating them one by one, completely lost in the ecstasy of eating again. When I stopped munching, I was pretty far from the trail, though I could still see my pack. I licked and sucked my fingers, savoring every bit of sugary juice, wanting to stay there forever. But every minute I picked berries left me a minute further from the mailbox many miles ahead, with all the real food in it. I filled my pockets with berries and was walking back towards my pack when something else blue caught my eye. Snagged on a low branch near the trail was a filthy but familiar bandana. I bent over and sniffed the brown stains. Coffee. Tupac was here not too long ago. I now had a mission. I tied the bandana to my pack and vowed to return it to its rightful owner. This would give me something other than food to focus on while I marched. The diversion worked. When I made my camp a few miles south of Monson, I had actually forgotten the berries in my pockets. They were a real surprise for the second time. I turned my pockets inside out to pick out the remaining pulp, sucking at the purple stains like a baby at a nipple. I still had my raisin when I saw the cabins at the outfitters 2 miles from Monson. All of the doors and windows were wide open for cleaning, and the man out front was about to set fire to a good-sized brush pile. "Wow, am I glad to see you," I said, hurrying toward him. "Are you guys open?" He took off his gloves and put them in a pocket. "Just closed for the season yesterday. Is there anything left in the store? I'll gladly pay for anything edible. I'll even eat gum." "Sorry, we're all cleaned out. You can check the hiker lounge, though. Maybe some old ramen or something in the donation box. You're welcome to it if you can find anything." I barely heard him finish and was already halfway to the cabin he indicated. The donation box was empty, but there was a half-eaten bag of unsalted peanuts on the table next to a warm, unopened can of Mountain Dew. I popped the lid and chugged, and sweet, life-giving bubbles fizzed on my tongue and in my throat with every greedy gulp. My eyes watered and my sinuses stung. I fell to my knees and released a long, satisfying burp. The guy outside laughed. I wiped my eyes and caught my breath. "Do these nuts belong to anyone?" "Nope. Have at 'em." Carrying the bag and cracking shells with one hand, I walked to town. Nuke was right. Monson consisted of 2 hostels, 1 open restaurant, and the post office. When the clerk passed my boxes across the counter, I could smell the meat and chocolate inside. I drooled a little as I paid and tore off the tape before I made it to the door. At a hostel named Shaw's, an old woman chain-smoking Benson and Hedges took my cash, pointed me to my room with a shaky yellow finger, and returned to her romance novel. The young woman working inside was much happier to see me and welcomed me with cookies and clean sheets. I unpacked in the bunk room alone. 2 couples were staying overnight in the private rooms. The 5 of us ate together and conducted a mini hiker grapevine at dinner, where I learned that the bubble had split. 1/2 of them were a day or 2 ahead, and the other 1/2 a day behind. According to the folks at Shaw's, we were the only ones in the middle. Everyone was still nervous about the 100-mile wilderness, and we all wanted to get through it as quickly as possible. The finish line was in sight, and the last month of hiking had felt like driving a sports car through a series of red lights.
How many days are you going to do it in?
I'm trying for 4. I heard that this one guy, he did it in 3.
No way!
Really, I could see it though. Like, your adrenaline would get going and you can't sleep, so you night hike. I could totally see it.
Yeah, how about you, Green Giant? How many days are you doing it in?
I closed one eye, did some math, chewed a forkful of dinner and swallowed. 7, maybe 8, we'll see.
Are you okay? Are you, like, sick or something? Or hurt?
No, I just don't want this to end. I just remembered that they have the bucket service here. We should do that. For a reasonable fee, Shaw's will give you a 5-gallon plastic bucket which can easily hold enough food for the next 50 miles for several hikers. They will hang it in a bear-proof location near the road crossing and paint your name on it. This is the only way to resupply in the 100-mile wilderness.
It's like $50. No way.
I looked at them like they were crazy.
That's only $10 each.
No, we're couples, so it's $20 each. We're not falling for that one. I gave up. I had a full plate of mashed potatoes in front of me and 1/5 of a supply bucket ready to go on the back porch.
That's okay. I already paid anyway, so I'll be taking 8 days.
And not going hungry.
You already did the bucket thing?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Hey, can we, like, put some stuff in it?
No way. The sign that the Maine Appalachian Trail Club has posted at the southern end of the 100-mile wilderness says, "There are no places to obtain supplies or get help until A-Ball Bridge, 100 miles north. Do not attempt this section unless you have a minimum of 10 days' supplies and are fully equipped. This is the longest wilderness section of the entire AT, and its difficulty should not be underestimated." It ends with, "Good hiking." We were the only carload of hikers to be dropped off at the trail that day. The couples took pictures by the sign, and after they headed north, I lingered until I couldn't hear them anymore. I waited a few more minutes just to be sure I was alone. 7 miles into the wilderness, I arrived at Little Wilson Falls. A narrow stream flowed over a wide bed of smooth slate, funneling into a tight notch at the top of a 75-foot drop into a box canyon. Trees of every color surrounded the massive rock columns. The sun filtered through the leaves and shone on the rocks like the light through a stained glass window. Just above the roaring falls, I found an easy rock hop to a footpath on the other side. It led to a hidden campsite just far enough upstream to soften the roar down to a soothing whisper. It was the middle of the day. I'd only traveled 7 miles, and my hands were setting up my tent as if they had a mind of their own. Well, I thought, looks like I live here now. I spent the afternoon climbing around on the slate columns, basking in the sun. At night, I built a fire on the rocks near the water. No one could possibly hear me, so I stood at the top of the falls and howled at the stars. The next morning, I dunked my feet into the cool water beside my fire and ate generously. The package I mailed myself from Rangeley had extra protein bars, and they appeared to be working. Either that, or I was losing my sense of smell completely. With nowhere to buy refills, I had finally run out of water purification drops, and was now just filtering stream water through the blue bandana, and that was it. Sometimes I'd miss a twig or a small stone, but as Bad Dinner claimed, that's what a mustache is for. My next stop was the shelter at Cloud Pond. I pitched my tent 3 feet from the still water and learned in the morning why the place was called Cloud Pond. Despite the previous night's clear sky, I woke up in a perfect whiteout. My headlamp was useless, and I found my way up to the shelter by feeling the ground. I wrote in the logbook, "Lemmy, I am going slow on purpose." I stopped writing. Should I have included Voldemort in the note? Was that even remotely possible at this point? I wished, but I also knew better. I simply added my signature smiley, closed the book, and crawled back to my tent in the fog. While I was packing, I heard a tremendous splash, followed by a heavy thud and a loud plunk. My first thought was that a small car had somehow crashed into the pond. A second splash was followed by something that sounded like a moo, and then more splashing. Peering through the fog, I discerned the hazy forms of 2 moose, a bull and a cow. The bull was shaking the water from its huge rack, and I concluded that getting smacked by an antler that big would be fatal. Fortunately, the creatures were on the far shore and posed no danger. I watched them laze about in the muck and silently gathered my tent. My resupply cache had been delivered without a hitch. I opened the plastic tub and knelt beside it in the leaves, tearing open a protein bar with my teeth. The only sound besides the wind rustling in the treetops was me grunting and smacking my lips as I hunched like a predator over the guts of my plastic prey. I wiped my hands on my pants and briefly considered taking the bucket. If things got bad again, I could use it to trap a squirrel. That night, necessity unexpectedly went into labor. Around 2 a.m., I felt water on my face, a lot of it. As I sat up, chilly water ran down my hair, into my shirt, and down my back. The rainfly was flapping uselessly in the wind, and rain was spattering down from the screened opening at the top of the tent and blowing in sideways through my door. I pushed everything into the foot of my tent, as far from the opening as I could, and checked my shoes for slugs. Finding none, I put them on and donned my raincoat, then stepped into the rain and flicked on my headlamp. The zipper on my rainfly had broken, and when the flap fell open, the entire night's catch had dumped onto my face. I had no sewing kit, and tape wouldn't hold. The nearest shelter was a day away. Eventually, I hung my raincoat over the opening like an umbrella. I only had to wake up and fix it twice, and in the morning it didn't matter because the rain had stopped. Just to be safe, I spent the next night in a shelter. I left Lemmy another note, and it rained again. I dreamed that I was still in my tent, and that my raincoat had fallen onto my face. Then I realized a mouse was burrowing into my beard, looking for warmth, nesting material, or crumbs. I panicked, pulling out some whiskers along with the stowaway, and threw him across the shelter. He squeaked on impact with the wall, followed by a second little thunk an instant later, and then the sound of tiny scurrying feet. Luck shone on me one final time, my final night in the 100-mile wilderness. I didn't need a shelter, and I didn't need my rainfly. I found a campsite on flat, soft ground, surrounded by tall pines and rainbow-colored softwoods. The forest was lit like the inside of a cathedral, and I knew as I moved through it that Katie was near. If she had stuck to her plan, as she always does, then she had been in Maine for 2 days already. I wondered if she had explored this far, and expected her at every turn. It wasn't realistic. I was still 20 miles from the base camp that she would have just set up for us after driving for 2 days. She wasn't hiking this far. I was still alone. But it was fun to imagine, and the idea propelled me forward. My food bag was nearly empty again, but this time it no longer mattered. There were no more resupplies. I binged on pasta, following it up with nearly a pound of hard salami and a block of cheese. For dessert, there was a special treat, some dark chocolate with a hint of hot pepper. I washed the whole bar down with a cold bottle of honest-to-goodness crystal-clear Maine spring water. They charge you for this in the grocery store, I thought, and chugged another. The rushing of a nearby river began lulling me to sleep by my small fire. I didn't need my tent, but climbed in anyway. The trail had, after all, been full of surprises. The night was cold and clear, and the moon woke me up 3 times. My adrenaline was responsible for the other 2 times, and the final reveille was due to a combination of sunshine and my full bladder. Light was hitting the mist from the river at just the right angle to produce tiny rainbows. The little splashes of pee at the base of the poor tree I chose did the same. I must have stood up too quickly when getting out of my tent because I briefly saw spots. Steadying against the tree and taking a deep breath, I felt dinner gurgle and settle in my gut, followed by an urge to fart. Only what happened next wasn't a fart. I let go of the tree and yanked my shorts to my knees with a split second to spare, barely avoiding the powerful jet of soupy brown goo that sprayed from my ass. I wobbled forward and pulled my shorts further down just in time to miss the second stream as it exploded into a grotesque pile between my feet. The volume was surprising, and it came with no sense of relief, its origin a mystery. Crouching there frozen in place, unsure whether there would be more, I waddled away from the mess and did my best to clean myself off with leaves. My bathroom bag was in my tent, and I was not going in there without at least a cursory wipe down. Once I was satisfied that my body was properly sanitized, I disposed of my waste. Fortunately, I had walked far enough from the campsite and the river that I didn't have to worry about moving it. I dug a hole beside the pile deep enough to create a miniature cave-in, a shit sinkhole. When it collapsed, I filled it in and covered it with the heaviest rock I could move without hurting myself. No one ever needs to find this, I thought. Surprisingly, I felt pretty good after what I'd just been through, including the digging and heavy lifting, the lack of rest, the horrible diet, and so on. My adrenaline had been coursing for days, and I couldn't sleep. I didn't night hike, but I certainly could have. Things were coming to a head. I was burning up on re-entry, that was all. With stress comes a little rumble gut. I gave it no more thought as I folded up my little portable home for the last time on the AT. Abel Bridge has a tiny campsite and general store at the northern edge of the 100-mile wilderness. There is also a bridge from which one can usually see Mount Katahdin. The bridge was foggy that day, but the general store was open, and I rushed in, eager to buy something hot to eat. I found a ham and cheese sandwich to microwave while I chatted with the clerk. "You're the first one here today," he said. "No kidding. How were the last few days?" I asked, moving to the ice cream counter. "Busy, then slow. We had some weirdos yesterday. About 50 the day before. That's why there's not much left. Sorry." The ice cream was gone. I got my sandwich, thanked him, and paid, and stepped back outside, where a young man with a tattered pack and a clean-shaven face recognized me. He ran across the parking lot. "Hey, Green Giant! You're a hot commodity. Did you know that?" I held up a finger and wondered why everyone felt compelled to ask me questions while I was eating. Perhaps because hikers are always eating. "I'm so sorry. I don't recognize people with naked faces," I said, drawing an imaginary circle around my bearded chin. He reintroduced himself as Redfoot. We'd only met briefly 1,000 miles ago, and he'd had a beard then. "Well, thanks for remembering me, at least. I'm flattered. And what do you mean by hot commodity?" "There are some people back there pretty excited to catch up with you," he said, pointing a thumb over his shoulder. "Some? Is one of them Lemmy? Is that how you knew who I was?" "Yep, and Voldemort talks about you a lot, too." I was dumbstruck. Lemmy, I expected. I'd been leaving him notes and had even slowed down for him. I knew where he was. But Voldemort? Megan? Redfoot laughed. "Yeah, she said you'd be surprised. She also said that if she catches you coming down Katahdin, she'll slit your throat, or something like that. There were a few variations. I stopped paying attention." "How far back are they?" "Oh, you'll see them today." I gaped while Redfoot put his pack and poles by the door and walked into the store. Lemmy and Voldemort were probably 10 miles back. I finished my sandwich, leaned forward, and hiked as fast as I could. I didn't want it to be over. I wanted another 100 miles. Katie was 10 miles ahead, which gave me an unexpected burst of energy. I crawled over rocks and logs and clawed through moss. I balanced on planks and crossed rivers in my shoes and socks, not caring. When I turned the last corner and saw the row of shelters at the base of Katahdin, I stumbled to a halt. My car was parked beside one, and I could hear a familiar voice humming from inside. Cupping my hands around my mouth, I leaned back and shouted, "Woo-hoo!" Katie's head appeared from behind the shelter wall, and the instant she saw me, she ran at me, smiling. We collided and wrapped our arms around each other right there beside our little base camp. Noticing that her arms reached much farther around me than usual, she gave me a quizzical look, then tugged me back to her. We kissed, and I felt her wet cheek through my beard. She leaned back again and wiped her eyes. She laughed and smiled, and we kissed again. Finally pushing me back, she sniffed. "You look so thin. Oh my God. Wow, I missed you." I hugged her again, and she whispered in my ear, "Oh, and happy birthday." It had indeed taken me 8 days to traverse the 100-mile wilderness. I went in on October 1st and came out on October 8th, my 45th birthday. I threw my pack into the car. I didn't need it anymore. Katie brought me clean clothes straight from my dresser at home. They smelled like our dryer. She also brought food. It reminded me of Klingman's Dome. Vegetables, fruit, hot dogs, chips, drinks, and a cake with candles. Just as I was opening my mouth to compliment her on the cake, someone tackled us. I was briefly reminded of nearly being flung from Mount Washington, but this time I landed safely on the floor of the shelter in a tangle of arms. Katie and I sat up, and Voldemort, our assailant, shouted, "Green Giant! Katie! Oh my God, we made it! We're here!" She grabbed Katie by the hands, let go, and bounced in place beside our car. "Megan, you look amazing! Damn, look at you!" She rolled up her sleeve and flexed. "Aw, yeah, what do you think about this?" She raised her other arm. Boom! I was about to compliment her as well when I was blinded by an approaching headlamp. "You know what they say!" "Lemmy!" Katie interrupted. hugging him and kissing his koala hat on the nose. He blushed. You are warm. I was dizzy with joy. Hey, buddy! Megan, now finished flexing, asked Lemmy what he had been about to say. They say that the women on the AT all turn into Greek goddesses, and the men turn into trolls, he said. And look, it is true. This girl belongs on a gold coin. He shook his head at me, already with mustard smeared on my new pants and leaves in my hair from being tackled. You belong under a bridge. Megan's family had come to meet her and reserved a small shelter, too. Katie lit the candles on the cake, and everyone sang to me. While we were eating, a ranger joined us. "Whose birthday is it?" Everyone quieted. "Mine, sir. Sorry if we were being too loud." "Not at all. I came over to say happy birthday to whoever it was." He shined a light into the hatchback. "Cox, it's his birthday. You guys should be having beer to celebrate."
"I thought there was no alcohol allowed in the park," Katie said.
"Well, that's what they say," he smiled. "But as long as no one's causing a problem, no one really cares."
Megan had a bottle of champagne ready for the summit tomorrow.
What about this?
Don't drop it. Bring it back down and be smart.
Katie seemed surprised, but Voldemort and I weren't. We'd heard this same talk countless times the whole way. Common sense really meant something out here. We thanked him, and he congratulated us. We ate more cake, and I huddled between Katie and Lemmy, sleeping in a shelter for the last time on the AT. Standing at the base of Mount Katahdin, you would never guess that you were anywhere near the tallest mountain in Maine. The summit is 5 miles away and almost a vertical mile up. From the ground, any tall pile of rocks or grove of pines is enough to obscure the true scale of the behemoth. It starts like any other trail. There is a gentle approach through moss and conifers as it rises along a wide, clear stream with plenty of falls and crossings. Surrounded by trees, this first part could be anywhere in Maine. While we were loading up our day packs, Lemmy told us how they caught up. Megan had lucked out with only sunny, clear days in the Whites, making it through them in half the time it had taken me. She caught Lemmy halfway through the 100-mile wilderness and reminded him about our epic night hike up Roan Mountain while she goaded him into a 50-mile day.
"She was like the Terminator, Green Giant. She would stop for nothing!"
They hiked continuously for a day and a half, reading my notes and sleeping only once for 20 minutes. Lemmy seemed to have forgiven her because he kept chasing after her for the first mile that day. Then we literally hit a wall. A towering rock monolith was studded with steel rebar pounded in to form rungs and handholds. Were it not for these, we definitely would have needed ropes. At the top of the wall, we zigged and zagged through more towers, each 20 to 30 vertical feet, separated by narrow, flat places, with only enough room for one person to stand. Trekking poles were of no use here. As we climbed, the trees thinned, and when they were gone, the wind picked up. We had just stopped to put on extra layers when we noticed a hiker with a long, white beard resting nearby. He waved when we passed, and we noticed with shock that his beard wasn't actually white. It was covered with ice.
"Holy shit, dude. Is it really that bad up there? I mean, congratulations. But is that ice?"
"It is," he said. "Once you get up to the tableland, everything is covered. It's probably low 20s, maybe upper teens up there. Look at this."
He snatched a water bottle from his pack, unscrewed the lid, and turned it upside down. Nothing came out.
"Frozen solid. And I was only up there for about a half an hour. Once you get up to the tableland, the wind is insane."
Lemmy frowned.
"This sounds like hell to me."
Voldemort, spurred on by impending mortal danger, was already 100 yards up the trail, charging toward it. The tableland marks the beginning of the third and final phase of the climb. After several miles of near-vertical boulder scrambles, we ultimately pulled ourselves up to a massive plateau that resembled the set of a vintage science fiction movie, an otherworldly expanse with basketball-sized rocks and stunted alpine brush forming a vast frozen hump. The trail was marked by thin ropes and low cairns drawing us ever upward toward the horizon, toward Baxter Peak and the famous wooden sign. Rime ice covered every surface. The God of Thunder must have been about, because the summit was shrouded in gray, freezing mist. Lemmy and Megan succumbed to their adrenaline and sprinted up the rugged incline all the way to the top, vanishing in the clouds.
Katie and I were almost to the summit when we saw Lemmy walking back down toward us.
"What the hell is he doing?" Katie shouted over the wind.
When he reached us, I asked him the same question. "I have to go back down," he answered. "I am going to die up there." I made a hook with my right pinky finger and shook it at him. Then I pointed back to the summit.
"It's so cold," he protested. "I am freezing."
"If I give you extra layers to wear, will you go back up?" I shouted, pulling him close. "We have to do this together. This isn't just any other mountain. We pinky swore."
Rooting through my pack, I pulled out my down jacket and the wind pants that Katie had brought me. They weren't going to fit over his own bulky pants, so I cut the waistband with my knife.
"You'll have to use your pack strap to hold them up."
While the three of us put on the last of our layers, the wind pushed the remaining clouds away, and as we crested the last rise, we could see Megan at the summit, surrounded by a bright blue sky. Ornamenting the sign were balloons and a happy birthday banner Lemmy had given her to unfurl while he came back down and stalled me. A lump formed in my throat.
"I am a day late, Green Giant, but happy birthday!"
He hugged me, then hugged Katie, and we took the last few steps together. There were no more hand-over-hand scrambles, no more switchbacks. There was only one more pile of rocks, crusted with needles of ice. There was only one more white blaze, and it was on the sign, straight ahead. The 100-mile wilderness stretched out dizzyingly behind the sign and Megan and the balloons. The cold and copper treasure of autumn had expanded, and the forest below exploded with color as far as the haziest notch in the farthest horizon. The trail stopped going up, because there was no more trail. I shut my eyes and was transported back to Springer Mountain with Katie and Mark. I took another step and felt my feet pounding on all those jagged rocks. A swirling vision of hundreds of instant pasta sides flashed behind my closed eyelids. The wind on my face was the pelting storm that pinned us down in the whites. All the bug bites, blisters, bruises, and blood were for this. All that pain, joy, shivering, and loneliness. All that beauty. The long, unnamed places between horizons and water stops. All those sunsets and sunrises. Multitudes of birdsong, howling coyotes, crickets, and frogs. The laughter of other hikers around a fire at the next shelter. Feeling dizzy, I opened my eyes again. There was the sign. I moved closer in slow motion, drawn to it. I could see Megan holding balloons and Katie pulling her camera from its pouch. I leaned forward and kissed the sign.
"I am in hell. Can we go back down now?"
Lemmy begged, snapping me out of my trance.
"As soon as we get a group picture, buddy."
I pulled my friends in for a tight hug as tears froze on my cheek. Everything was finally right. Megan bit off one of her gloves and fumbled with numb fingers to open the champagne. There was a loud pop, but no spray of bubbles. It was partly frozen, almost turned to slush. We were inside a freezer at the top of the world. We were still happy to share the bottle. Katie took our picture and then asked Megan to get one of just the two of us by the sign. As Katie hugged me and kissed my frozen cheeks, she whispered, "Congratulations. How do you feel?" I closed my eyes again, and once more I was transported through time. As I exhaled, I recalled the wind on my face the morning I met Flatfeet, the day Green Giant came to be. The Triple Crowner had asked me the very same question. "I feel fantastic." I closed my eyes one last time, and for a moment, I could almost hear the old man's voice. "Of course you do. You're just getting started."
Epilogue. The hike doesn't end at Katahdin. It never does. Baxter Peak is 5 miles and change from the campsite below. It takes the average thru-hiker 2 or 3 hours to reach the top, and the rest of their lives to get back down. Megan drove home with her folks, and we left Lemmy in Miss Janet's care. Katie and I took our time getting home. We visited some of her relatives in Maine, and spent a night in Boston with Joe, who did not wear a fake mustache this time. We even stayed with Lode in Pennsylvania, where Katie was amazed by the Garage Mahal, and Lode let us sleep in the house. At each of these places, everyone was shocked by my appearance. They put heaps of food before me, but I couldn't eat. This loss of appetite, I reasoned, was because I had suddenly switched from walking to sitting all day.
burning zero calories in the passenger seat, I didn't need to consume any. Or sometimes, I felt too tired to eat. I woke up queasy each day and continued to have frequent, unpleasant bouts of diarrhea. I blamed that on switching back to real food. My gut was confused, that was all. Katie finally convinced me to see a doctor after